Network, proudly presents The Jay's Blade Show. With your host, CyberGolf.com's own Jay Clemmer, and co-starring a galaxy of the golf and sports world's greatest names as a special guest. Yo, 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 this is your main man, DJ Q, telling you to put your hands together for your friend and mine, Jay Clemmer.
All right, thank you, DJ Q. He is absolutely right. You're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. I am Jay Flemma. Welcome to the show and welcome to 2019, which promises to be a phenomenal year in golf, whether it's the majors or whether it's traveling around to some of the more exotic places in the world. It's going to be a fantastic year. We're going to see Pebble Beach, we're going to see Bethpage, and we're going to see Northern Ireland for the first time in a very long time. Jay's Place is brought to you by JB's Best Hot Sauce. It's the spiciest, it's the boldest, it's the most amazing hot sauce out there on the market. It's on every table in the Deep South, and it should be on yours. When it says JB's, it's the best. All right, everybody, let's jump right into this first show of the year. We're bringing back two of our very favorite people, two of the smartest minds in all of golf course design. It's a real pleasure to have them on the show once again. Please give a warm Jay's Plays welcome to preeminent golf course architect Tom Doak and one of the brightest minds in golf course architecture, the proprietor of Golf Club Atlas and now one of the three people in charge of the Golf Week rating panel, Rand Morissette. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks, Sam.
Glad to be back.
Well, I guess let's start it with you have finally finished the fifth book in the Confidential Guide to Golf Courses series. And it's been a long road, but this one is particularly interesting because it's got a lot of Asia and Australia and some really exotic destinations. Tom, why don't you start by telling us about the scope of this final book?
Well, the first thing I have to explain is it's not the final book. when I started the project, I laid out books number 1 through 5, and the Asia and Australia and New Zealand book was to be the last. And then as I got busy a couple of years ago and had several trips to make to New Zealand and Australia, it was just easier to go ahead and finish this book and put off the one for Europe and Africa where I didn't have time to travel. So this is still volume 5, but volume 4 isn't done yet. So if some of your listeners are wondering why they didn't get volume 4, that's why. It'll be another couple of years before we get there.
Okay, interesting. We're going to, you know, jump around in counting, but that's fine. Everybody can still pull out their pens and put them in the map. So tell us some of the most exotic and exciting places that you visited.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I'd traveled to Australia and New Zealand quite a bit for playing golf and for business over the years. We've built 4 golf courses there and consult on several others. So I thought I had that pretty well covered, although I did get to see a few little places in New Zealand I wouldn't have gotten to if it wasn't for trying to do research for the book. But I really hadn't traveled in Asia a whole lot. I mean, Masa Nishijima, who's one of our co-authors, is a good friend, so I'd seen, you know, 10 or 20 golf courses in Japan at the top end of the line, but not much else. So, you know, over the last 2 years or 2.5 years, I've made my first real trips to Korea, to Vietnam, to, I've been to China working on a project, but I did see some other things there, and in Hong Kong. I went to Guam and Saipan, which most people couldn't find on a map, and Fiji and Samoa. And my last trip to wrap it up was going to India and Sri Lanka, which was probably the most exotic or craziest. And Nepal too. I'd actually gone to the Himalayan Golf Club in Nepal 4 or 5 years ago, just when I started this thing. And that's still one of the coolest experiences of my life.
Yeah, I noticed when you sent your Christmas card out, thank you, by the way, that you specifically mentioned both Himalayan and, am I pronouncing this right, Hyderabad in India?
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit more detail about both of those golf courses? Who were they designed by? What kind of courses are they? Are they easy to get to?
Oh, well, easy to get to is all relative in Asia. The two you've named aren't as hard as some of the other things I've seen. So I'll start with Hyderabad. Hyderabad is a big city in India. It's after Bangalore, it's one of the high-tech cities, and Google and Oracle and all kinds of Silicon Valley companies have offices there. So it's this crazy contrast of an old city that's, you know, tiny little alleyways and rubble and a million people crammed into a small space, and then you go 10 miles away to the other side of town and it's big executive office park places. It's really crazy. They only had, you know, up till 15 years ago, Hyderabad was a huge city with no golf courses at all, because it's kind of in a, you know, it's a semi-arid climate and it gets really hot in the summer, and, you know, they just never thought about doing golf and trying to maintain grass there. And then about 10 years ago, two projects were done at the same time. One was like a residential development course called Boulder Hills that was funded by a Middle Eastern company. You know, sort of a desert highlands style golf course. And then this Hyderabad Golf Club that I played is a public golf course started by a few local golfers. I don't really know who to give the credit to. They had an architect named David Hemstock that helped them a little, but I understand that they built most of the golf course with local help and local golfers. Most of the golf course is set inside this huge old ruin of a fort called the Golconda Fort, which must cover 500 acres because you see a high part of the fortress way off in the distance on top of a hill. But you're still inside the same walls. And you've got tees built up kind of on the parapets in some places, and you've got greens that, you know, holes that play up into the high end, and then an island green and a lake that you play off a slope to. And I mean, it's a crazy place. It doesn't fit together all that well in places. You know, when we went into the fort, I spent the next three holes trying to figure out how we were going to get out the same place we got in, because we sort of boxed it. We boxed it off right away the way the routing went. And sure enough, when you get to the 17th hole, all of a sudden you know, it comes back to kind of their halfway house, and then somebody picks you up and takes you back across two other fairways to get through the tunnel and out to the 18th tee.
Is it a bit like Brickyard Crossing, where all of a sudden you go into the speedway and play four holes and then come back out? Is it a bit like that?
Yeah, I suppose so. But you know, in this case, most of the golf course is in the fort, and there's only the first hole on the practice range, or the first, I think it was three holes, I guess, in the practice range that are out of the fort.
Are there any other golf courses nearby that are worth seeing that you could make sort of a week trip or a five-day trip to India viable?
Well, that's the funny thing. I mean, you know, with the help of a young golf course architect in India named Vijit Nanderjog, who somebody put me in touch with, I put together this 10-day itinerary, well, actually 2 weeks to see courses in India and Sri Lanka. And as soon as I sent, you know, he offered to help however he could, and as soon as I sent the itinerary to him, he did a double take because he knew how aggressive it was to try to get around. You know, the courses are not close together at all, and getting around from one city to another, and then, you know, a couple of the courses that I picked out were like old British Army outpost type places that built a golf course in the late 1800s, and they aren't close to any big airports. So we just traveled at breakneck pace for 2 weeks to see the places we did. I wish it was easier to see the group of courses I did in a trip that would be viable for most people, but I gotta say it would be pretty hard. You know, the one thing though is there's four or five places around India, and not just in Delhi, where you would want to seek out golf if you went there. I mean, there was some really interesting stuff, you know, sort of very crude by our modern standards. You know, in Delhi, they've got Craig Norman and Jack Nicklaus signature courses. But once you go out in the country, you're on very interesting pieces of property, and they don't have a lot of water for irrigation, and they don't, you know, they don't mind having crossover holes because not that many people play on a given day. So,
and well, crossover holes can be quite fun though if you do them right.
Oh, yeah.
Rockaway Hunting Club in Bayonne have wonderful crossovers. It's kind of charming to see your fellow golfers coming your way as you're going out the other way.
Yep, and you know, if the golf course isn't super busy, it works great.
Now, how about Himalaya? I know you raved about that one as well. That had to be difficult to get to somewhat, but it also had to be well worth it. The payoff to play golf in the Himalayas has to be one of those life experiences that everybody should try to get to.
Yeah, what a great place. And I know Ram's brother has been there too. So when I first came back and told everybody about it, everybody was like, no, you got to be kidding. You know, I mean, I literally got reactions from people like, you're making this up. It can't be like that. And then Ram's brother wound up over there a couple of years after I was, but something like Golf Club Atlas. So people know about it a little now. We aren't scooping the world with putting it in the confidential guide. But, you know, I honestly believe that's one of the places a golfer should try to get to sometime in their life. I mean, I really thought that highly of it, partly because Nepal is such a cool place, and partly because they built this golf course in just an incredible site down in a canyon with a, you know, it's mostly in a canyon, but a river runs out of the Himalayas, and, you know, from the clubhouse down into the bottom, it's like 250 feet downhill. And most of the holes are down in, but you can still see the mountains from there because the river is kind of running toward the, coming out of the mountains, and the mountains are so high and so close that you can still see them over the rim of the canyon. You know, you're at, I think the golf course is like 3,000 feet or 3,500 feet, so it's not really at a high altitude, and then 30 miles away is Annapurna, which is 27,000.
Sure.
So,
yes,
you know,
one of the highest peaks in the world.
And it's like, you know, the first time you see it, it's like, oh, that's the moon. And then it's like, oh, shit, that's not the moon.
Who was the designer of the club?
The designer and builder was a major from the Army who developed the thing as his retirement project. He'd never built a golf course before. He only played golf a little. He went back to Britain where he spent some time to go to places like Sunningdale and try to get a sense of the scale of what he was trying to do. And then came back and sort of barehanded building a golf course with a bunch of local laborers and one broken down bulldozer and a little advice from Ron Freem, the U.S.
Sure.
architect who's done a lot of work in the Far East and a lot of work on those kinds of like underfunded crazy sites.
What kind of good architectural strategies will we find at Hyderabad and at Himalaya?
Well, Himalayan is just, I mean, the reason I liked it so much is it's so different than anything I've seen, in a good way. You know, it's like,
sure, yes,
like all the, you know, we talk a lot. We love firm and fast golf courses, like Lynx golf courses, and you know, we talk about those so much. It's like that's the default of what you try to do now when you're building a golf course. And then,
thankfully, yes.
But that's not really going to work at the foot of the Himalayas. It's not sandy. You know, some of the fairways get flooded some of the time in the spring. Those grasses don't grow. So, you know, major
Ram Gurung, who built the golf course, kind of had to reinvent everything based on local conditions and based on not having much water and having tougher soils and what kind of grasses would grow. So, you know, he built, so, you know, the one thing that looked like it would work for fairways with pretty much no chemical use at all was zoysia grass, which is very slow to establish. And as you know, zoysia grass is kind of sticky compared to most other grasses. The ball
yes, it is.
Much. It's more like, you know, it's kind of like Velcro. It lands once and, or twice and stops.
Right.
So the fairways don't have to be as wide because the ball's not going to roll out so much, which is good because it's a narrow canyon. And then the greens don't have to be as big because if the ball gets off them, there's zoysia around it and it doesn't get away way too far. But then it's a tricky little shot back. So, you know, he did it the way you should do it. He looked at local conditions and what he had to work with and came up with something that works instead of, you know, applying what works everywhere else and trying to make it work.
Sure. Instead of forcing a square peg into a round hole.
Right.
So. Now, Rand, let's get you to jump in on this as well. It's fascinating that your brother was one of the ones who sort of, I could say, discovered, or rather, you know, turned the world onto Himalaya. What can you tell us about your experiences there, and also tell us what other courses that we haven't talked about that you found exotic and exciting in the region?
Well, I will say, in between Tom's profile of the Himalayan and my brother's, it's the one course in the world that I would most like to see now, for all the reasons that Tom just touched on and that my brother enumerated in the course profile on Golf Club Atlas. And relative to all the courses in Asia, you know, in Volume 5, that would be, you know, that's the one that holds the most appeal to me. And then, Jay, you know, relative to my input in Volume 5, most of it comes from having lived in Australia for 7 years, and I did a stint in Auckland and Singapore and Hong Kong, and so saw some courses then. But really, you know, much of Volume 5 was Masa and Darius working with Tom. But, you know, the surprising thing, once I received the final edition, I didn't go back to check this, but I gave, you know, three perfect scores in this volume. And when Tom broke out how the five volumes were going to be done, you know, my worry was how interesting would this volume be. Most of the readership is in North America, so it's the furthest, you know, volume.
The furthest point on the globe away from these places, right?
Yeah, and I really think it came out so well. I mean, without any doubt, it's, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan are the anchors of the book, in large part because they have such a great golf culture. You know, there was all kind of, you know, building in China, for instance, can run hot and cold, but
yes,
the golf culture there has never taken hold. But the golf culture in Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, you know, much like the one in North America and the UK, dates back to the golden age of architecture, and so they set the right tone early on. And so it just turns out that there's a lot more of interest in the volume than I would have suspected going in.
Now, pick out some places that would be affordable for ordinary families or for general public officers who are looking for something different. You know, for somebody who wants to say, I want to go where none of my pals have gone, you know, but not quite so much a shoestring budget, but can you string together maybe 5-day itineraries for me, either one of you or both, that you would recommend to your pals?
Oh, by far the easiest ones for Americans to travel to, even though they're the farthest away, are Australia and New Zealand. You know, partly because the time to go there is when it's the winter here. So, and that's true of a lot of the places in Asia, too. I was surprised that even the Himalayan Golf Club, I went there the 1st of December, and that was the right time of year because it's the dry season. What you don't want to be there is when the snow starts melting off the mountains. Then the golf course might go underwater. But as far as, you know, travel in Asia is very expensive. And most of the best courses in Japan and South Korea are private and really tough to access and really expensive if you can't access them. You know, Australia and New Zealand now, again, golf is still pretty cheap. You know, it's cheap enough that people in Melbourne that are really interested in golf will be members of 2 or 3 clubs. Because it doesn't cost that much to belong. And, you know, New Zealand is kind of an odd dichotomy. There's a few courses like Jack's Point and Kidnappers and Carey Cliffs that you see in all the magazines, and they're spectacular places. I mean, they're some of the prettiest golf courses in the world. And, you know, they charge a fortune to play them, and they probably lose money anyway because people in New Zealand can't afford to play those courses, and it's hard to get that many people to come from America and England to play them. But by the same token, there's a bunch of little courses in Australia and New Zealand that are pretty inexpensive, really inexpensive.
Such as? Which ones?
Oh, in New Zealand, Paraparam.
Sure, yes.
Near Wellington is still, you know, that's been rated as one of the top 100 courses in the world. I think it's still about $100 to play. Barnboogle in Tasmania that I built is still just barely over $100 to play for one of the top 25 courses in the world. It is by far the least expensive one. And the reason it is, you know, it's a little remote for Australians, but it's mostly, you know, Australians don't want to pay a lot of money for golf. So, you know, other than Royal Melbourne, most of the courses you would visit in Australia are affordable for Americans to play. They're not any more expensive than any nice resort course you would go to here.
And Jay, the kissing cousin of Paraparuma Beach in Australia is Newcastle Golf Club, where I was a member for 5 or 6 years. And I haven't played there recently, but I would imagine the green fee structure is quite similar to Paraparam. You know, it's ideal land for golf, and they didn't clutter it up. And it's the UK pricing model where it might be $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 to join, and you know, $1,000 a year to be a membership. And if you think that somebody in Australia or New Zealand could pay much more than that, you'd be sadly mistaken, just like you.
Happily mistaken. Okay, I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear that people are tired of paying billions of dollars to play golf.
Well, and you get the warmest welcomes. And the greatest disservice that Americans can do is not spend a day or two or three at some of these places, because they're list chasers and they're just trying to hit 10 points on a map in 6 or 7 days. And you just get cheated from meeting the locals and getting a sense of their culture, and just in a lot of places, the more laid back vibe. So, you know, the best advice I would recommend, you know, is to don't, you know, when you go on one of these 2-week trips from North America, you know, don't try and play more than seven or eight or nine courses, but then loop back and see them one or two or three times. I mean, Pere Param is in one of the windier locations in the world. And I remember...
That sounds great to me. Give me more wind.
Jay, and the difference between a morning and an afternoon round for me was the difference between a wedge and a three-wood into the 13th hole. I'll never forget that. And so that's a perfect example of a course that you want to see. And, you know, the conditions will change every 12 hours, so don't just rush away.
Well, that's the kind of thing that an ardent golfer wants, though, okay, that the course will play differently every time and that it's going to be such an extreme swing like that. Nay wind, nay golf. And so that sounds absolutely exciting to me. So now let's talk a little bit about Japan and Korea. I want to start with Japan because Japan has become one of the two hottest skiing destinations in the world right now, along with Chile. And so Japan has gotten my attention not only for that reason, but also for golf. So tell us, architecturally speaking, what are the imperatives to hit in Japan?
Well, Tom will tell you. I mean, Hugh Allison went over there, and he left an indelible imprint. His trip is no different than what McKenzie's trip meant to Australia. And, you know, his most prized course, Hirono, is presently being restored now, and that'll be fascinating to see. I mean, you look at old black-and-white photos, and just from a distance, you think you're looking at Pine Valley, but then the Japanese aesthetic over time had moved to a more manicured presentation. So it really will be fascinating to see how far the architects are allowed to push the envelope with that restoration. And that, you know, that's arguably one of the, you know, golden dozen designs, Jay, of all time, at least when it opened and based on all the black and white photos. But, you know, personally speaking, when I was there 2 years ago, of course, a couple hours away from it, Nehru won my heart, and that was built by some locals that then Allison refined. But I've never seen, I mean, you can count on, you know, maybe 20 courses that have a set of par fours as strong as that one. It's just, it's landforms, jumbled landforms that you just don't see in North America. And I don't know why in particular you see them at places like Hirono and Nehru.
What do you mean when you say jumbled landforms?
Well, it's just the valleys and the hills and the ridges are, you know, unique. I can't think of a course that has similar topography in North America to that. And so, obviously, Jay, if you're going to make a 13-hour flight or something, you're hoping to see something different. And you will see that. And I haven't been to Kiwana. I know that's one of Tom's favorites, and it's referred to as the Pebble Beach of Japan. And again, it's just some very unique, almost in that case, turbulent landforms.
I mean, the trip that Allison made to Japan in 1931 can't be underestimated as like the moment for golf in Japan. It just raised their expectations entirely about golf. They tried to get, you know, Tokyo Golf Club, they tried to get Harry Colt to come over, and Colt just didn't like to travel that much, and getting to Japan from England was pretty hard to do. So
so Allison made the trip by ship around Africa and all the way to Tokyo. And you know, while he was there, you know, two or three members of Tokyo Golf Club took him to other things that they, you know, the club that they might be involved with, and asked him to help. And somebody, you know, one of the hotel developer took him to the site for Kiwanis and said, I want to do this here, do a project here. Can you help me lay it out? You know, which they had a preliminary layout from one of the local architects, but Allison got involved with him and changed it all around. And, you know, if it hadn't have been for the war, they probably would have kept building at that level. But, you know, but really just those six or seven projects that Allison was involved with, you know, set the bar real high, and then it was a long time before they got back to building golf courses in Japan again. You know, the one problem with Japan for a golf trip is that Hirono and Naruo and Tokyo Golf Club are really, really private. You know, it may be a little different now than it was when I was at Hirono 25 years ago, but there weren't many white people there that day. You know,
no.
On the contrary, Kiwanis is only about 2 hours from Tokyo by train and connecting train and then a van to get you down to the resort. And it's an international resort. They have people from all over the world come there, but especially people from Japan, you know, and it's the most dramatic of, Allison's work there. It was built on kind of on top of volcanic rock overlooking the ocean. And it's a spectacular place. It's, you know, it's always been my choice for the front of the book, for the Gourmet's Choice and the Confidential Guide, precisely because it is the one course that the readers could go play. You know, I don't think there's a lot of point in putting a lot of courses in the front of the book that people can't play no matter who they are. So, you know, I've always been really high on Kiwanis. It's a spectacular site. There's some really, you know, the first hole must be 75 or 100 feet downhill toward the water. So, you know, like almost like 10 at Augusta, but looking at the sea at the same time.
And sort then, of like perhaps number one at Rockaway Hunt Club, only maybe even more dramatically downhill.
Way more downhill.
Okay.
And you're still, you know, even when you get to the green, it's still on a bluff. You're still another, the water's 50 or 75 feet below that. So really dramatic. And then the third hole and the 17th hole, you play back up those same slopes. I mean, they are two of the steepest uphill holes I've ever seen on a really good course. And they work pretty well.
You know, how do they compare to two and how do they compare to 2 and 17 at Sleepy Hollow?
Oh, it's been a long time since I've been to Sleepy Hollow, but it's been a long time since I've been to Sleepy Hollow, so I can't compare. But I would bet anything that they're further uphill. I would bet they're, Pasatiempo is my standard for an uphill.
Okay,
hole.
Sure, yes.
There's a couple holes there that are like 90 feet uphill from tee to green, and I bet those ones at Kiwanis are every bit of that, if not more.
So, Tom, how about 18 at Reddish Vale? Is that similar in that kind of ascent?
Well, it's different because, you know, because it's part of it's flat, and then it just goes jammed straight up the hill for the last 250 yards or whatever it is.
Right.
These are just kind of a steady 8 or 10% uphill, which is not, you know, not so much that the ball will hit in the fairway and roll back at you, but you're not going to get any roll out of it going in the opposite direction, and you're standing on a pretty good uphill slope to hit the next shot. So, you know, if you were hitting a short iron, you might hit it straight up in the air with the combination of lie and loft. And it just, you know, it makes them play really long. It's hard to hit that kind of shot when you're standing like that. But, you know, they're just good long holes set on a steeper slope than you would normally see.
Now, is it possible to ski and play golf in the same day at Japan?
In Japan,
I ask because
I don't
know. I'm looking at my skis right now.
I know there most of the courses there's a resort. I've never been to it. Masa wrote the reviews. There's a resort in the mountains called Teruizawa or something like that that has multiple golf courses as well as ski hills. But I don't know what the ski season is versus the golf season up there. I know.
Is it possible in Australia? Sorry, go ahead. Korea.
Korea did have that. I went to a place in the mountains. Most of the golf courses, new golf courses in Korea are around Seoul, but in the mountains, a couple hours outside of Seoul. And then if you go a little further out, I went to a Jack Nicklaus course called Phoenix Park that's also a ski resort and was part of the facilities for the Winter Olympics. And I know they had snow on the mountain while I was there, and they were playing golf. So I know you could do both at certain times of the year there.
But, Jay, the two sports that most put pressure on your legs are skiing and golf. And it sounds cool to try and do them in the same day. But after a good morning of skiing, I would think your legs would be shot.
you're talking to a man who routinely runs half marathons and then goes and plays golf afterwards. I had to do that in Boston, and I had to do that in Sleepy Hollow this year. And happily, with good training, I was able to do it. But you are right. They are the two hardest sports on your knees and on your legs, that's for sure, especially if you're skiing something like a white face. Here's a perfect example of how to do it, okay? Go ski either Magic Mountain or Stratton and then play Aquonic, which is only 10 minutes away.
Yeah, but
I'll tell you.
Ski mountains are open.
Yeah. If you want to do that, the best place in this book to do that is Queenstown, New Zealand.
I was about to ask if you could do that.
You'll have the snow on the mountains there for quite a bit overlap into the golf season. They can almost play golf 12 months a year in Queenstown, but you'll get some cold, rainy, miserable days in the winter. But most people, if you went kind of in the shoulder seasons there, like September, October, would be coming out of their winter, I'm sure you would be able to do both. And there's some, Queenstown is like New Zealand and microcosm in a way. There's a couple of very high-end, very expensive resort courses like Jack's Point, and then there is one of my favorite courses. It's actually the first course in the Gourmet's Choice in the Confidential Guide. It's this little place called Arrowtown, which is about 20 miles from Queenstown, and it's 5,700 yards, and it's got no bunkers at all. It's one of the coolest courses in the country.
What makes it so cool if it's short with no bunkers?
Rock outcroppings that come into play. So you have to be really careful about being aggressive with a drive because you might hit a rocky ridge and have it bounce to God knows where. And cool green complexes and a lot of good shorter holes. The front nine has like four or five really good shortish par fours on it.
And Jay, you've got to be quite careful how you ask that question. I mean, basically you're saying bunkers and length make a course interesting, and you've got two people on the phone who argue that with you all day long.
Oh, no, I was asking for you to educate us all as to why it was good. That wasn't a what makes it good. It was more a what makes it good. Now, we'll jump back to that part of the conversation in just a minute. But, by the way, everybody, this is Jay Plummer. You're listening to Jay's Place on the Golf News Net Radio Network, and we're talking with Golf Club Atlas and Golf Week's Rand Morissette and preeminent golf course architect Tom Doak. It's time right now for the trivia questions, the JB's Best Hot Sauce trivia questions, where you guys get to try to see if you can answer a trivia question correctly, win a quick bottle of hot sauce, and a t-shirt that says, I'm a hottie. Tom, you already won once, so we'll see
I've
if we can
t-shirt.
Get you.
I still wear the t-shirt.
All right, so, Rand, you're going to go first. Your category is football, since the playoffs start this weekend. That's kind of fitting.
Yep.
How many Dallas Cowboys have won Super Bowl MVP awards? how many Dallas Cowboys, and I mean while they were a Cowboy, not somebody that went to another team and then went under another uniform, how many people wearing the Dallas Cowboy uniform have won Super Bowl MVP awards?
While they were wearing the uniform.
Yes, while they were playing for Dallas, how many of them won Super Bowl MVP awards?
I would guess two.
The correct answer is, Tom, take a guess. See if you can pick this one off.
Four.
It's a tough question. The Cowboys have won five Super Bowls. And no Cowboy has ever won the award more than once. But the correct answer is actually seven. And the reason why is, in Super Bowl V, Chuck Howley, a defensive player for the Cowboys, won MVP even though the Cowboys lost that game to the Baltimore Colts, 13-10 on a last-second field goal. He had two interceptions and a ton of tackles, and he won the MVP award instead of one of the Baltimore Colts at that time. And then in another year, Harvey Martin and Randy White shared the award in the only time in Super Bowl history that more than one player won it at any given time. And then after that, you get Roger Staubach, Larry Brown, who picked off Neil O'Donnell twice in the Super Bowl. I still wear the scars of that stupid game because the Steelers outplayed the Cowboys that day. And then, of course, Emmitt Smith and Troy Aikman. So
I thought the gist was that Aikman had won it twice, Staubach had won it twice. That's what I was thinking, and I didn't realize they won it five times.
It's a very difficult question, considering the fact that one guy won it when the team lost, and then another time they shared the award. That's a very, very tough question. Tom, unfortunately, yours is even tougher. We have a new – well, the reason why
– expensive?
Well, no, it's not a matter of that. It's more a matter of you won once before, and so John Berwa, who's a golf writer for PGA.com, and they started making hot sauce, and it really took off. You can tell everybody how delicious it is because you've tried it.
I have tried it.
So your category is bad puns. Okay, the correct answer is the worst joke you can possibly make. Are you ready? I get that answer. So here we go. What was Beethoven's favorite fruit?
I need my wife on the phone for this one.
Or your kids, one or the other. This is a total popsicle stick joke, I guess. What was Beethoven's favorite fruit?
I'm not kidding.
Rand, you want to try to help him out?
Symphony, overture, I'm trying, none of it plays off fruit, so I'm lost.
Banana! I said bad puns. We got to do something. Somebody's got to have a word with JB about these questions that he sends me. I thought that was...
Shirt. That's the bottom line.
All right, well, he just did, actually. We did have a winner recently. We had the guys from Magic Mountain on to give us the ski report. We're doing that once in a blue moon, since people do like skiing and golf so much. And he got correct the name of the sports team that was sponsored by Chico's Bail Bonds. That happened to ring a bell? What infamous sports team was sponsored by Chico's Bail Bonds?
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that from a movie, but I can't think what movie.
Tatum O'Neal was in it. She played a girl pitcher. Nobody remembers the Bad News Bears?
Yeah, I remembered it. I just couldn't remember the title.
Is that the name of the team?
Yes, and the movie. It was the name of the movie and the name of the team. The Bad News Bears. So, all right, but speaking of skiing and golf, okay, you piqued my interest, Tom, and I'll ask you the same question, Rand. Okay, where are other places around the world, United States, Europe, anywhere, where is it, you know, absolutely best to ski and play golf on the same day?
Bend, Oregon.
Rand, your thoughts on that one?
I haven't been to Bend, but that would be the best golf mirrored to good skiing. Yeah, I just don't know the courses in the Alps, European Alps.
Nothing in Colorado or Utah, perhaps, or maybe even Vermont or New Hampshire.
I mean, you look at where Ballyneal is relative to the mountains, and you've got a long drive.
Yeah, that's not close. That's not close.
I know a number who does that, but there's a small plane involved.
Right, right. Although there's a few good places in Colorado that might not be far. Places like, say, courses that might be in either Grand Junction or some places that Jim Eng might have designed near, say, Aspen or Vail.
I mean, the golf season in Vail is like 4 months, but you're not skiing and playing golf there. The best thing about, I think you're right that there's probably some in Utah also, but you know, Bend, Oregon is kind of a high desert, and you've got, and those mountains are a lot, you know, they're close and they're a lot higher than the town. So you've still got snow on the mountains. Quite a bit of the year, even when you're well into golf season.
Jay, you've been to Black Mesa, New Mexico. Is there a ski near there?
Well, Taos is there. Taos is phenomenal. And we could have skied the day I played Black Mesa because it snowed. I played with Eddie Peck and his three dogs in a blinding snowstorm, one of the most adventurous days of golf of my life. Okay, we started at your course, Tom. We started at the Rawls course. We played the Rawls course on March 9th in a 40-mile-an-hour wind that knocked my 6'9" buddy off of a tee box, okay? We were playing the third hole, that par 3, and all of a sudden, he just staggers, lurching along, and almost falls off the tee box. And I'm like, what happened? He goes, oh, just a gust of wind near me blew me over.
Lubbock, you know, I've worked in some places like Bandon and Barnesville that are famous for being super windy, and Lubbock, Texas is the windiest place I've ever worked.
And I loved every second of it. Again, playing in a 40-mile-an-hour wind with those flags flapping, okay, the state of Texas flags to boot, too. Okay. That was a really adventurous round, and then Black Mesa the next day. I wonder if Albuquerque might be closer, or perhaps Paco Ridge, which, while it's not an architecture fan's, cup of tea, it was still a lot of fun to play. I'll be curious your thoughts. When we're done on the phone today, I'm packing up the car and headed to my beloved Whiteface Mountain. And, you know, there are two courses by Seymour Dunn in Lake Placid. So, you know, what are your thoughts on those two courses that are, you know, in the shadow of Whiteface?
Sadly, I have not seen those courses. I was 10 the last time I was in Lake Placid, so I've never seen them. There's even some course up there that Mackenzie supposedly visited for a day at some point when he was coming through the East Coast, but I don't know that anybody's ever confirmed that he was there.
Jay, I would like to mention, since you brought up the Rawls course, I mean, that people tuning into this are likely big fans of Tom's work, that, you know, a lot of Tom's work has received praise and notoriety. But for my money, his two most underrated courses, one appears in Volume 5, which is St. Andrews Beach, and the other would be the Rawls course in Texas, where they present it for fast and firm conditions, and then they have a wind sweep through. A lot of people, you know, might not see either, and they're both very reasonably.
Very affordable. They're $50 courses, okay, champagne quality at beer prices.
Well, I can tell you, your radio telecast is the only time that those two courses are going to be linked together.
Well, the other great thing about the Rawls course, the bunkering is absolutely out of this world. One of my favorite pictures in golf is me trying to extricate myself out of that bunker fronting the third green, because it's just so far above my head. It looks like Forsgate, those bunkers. You know, Tom, you should be praised for building bunkers that, you know, McDonald, Rainer, and Banks would have been nodding and saying, yeah, yeah, that's what we like. And also, it was... Go ahead.
Well, what we were trying to do there was build bunkers that were deep enough and narrow enough that the wind didn't get in them and just the thing right out. Because we just, you know, because we just had that experience at Pacific Dunes. You build those cool dunesy bunkers that everybody likes the look of, but there's a serious maintenance cost involved with keeping sand in them.
Well, and the other good thing that you did there, too, though, was build the berm around the course so that all you see is the golf course. You're not distracted by, you know, the surrounds of the college or the town.
Well,
you know,
usually, you know, that's the only course that I've done that. Usually I don't like to do it because that's when you get into, you're spending a lot more money moving earth to do that because you're, you know, whatever you're cutting to create a feature on the golf course. If you took that cut and put it between two holes, you'd make both holes really dramatic. But if you take it and put it out at the edge to block all the apartment buildings that are across the street, you only get half as much effect out of it. So in general, I've tried not to do that, but that site we just had to, you know, the two sides of the property weren't very attractive, and the donor, Mr. Rawls, who gave all the money to Texas Tech to build the golf course, did not want to be looking at those apartment buildings.
Right.
Jay, you know, I'll say this. If you go play Common Ground in outside of Denver, you might well think that that's one of Tom's courses. But if you played the Rawls course, because it's so atypical, Tom wouldn't be the first to come to mind, which is exactly why you want to go play the Rawls course.
Okay, tell me why. What are the differences and distinctions? What to you are the hallmarks of a joke course that you could identify at Common Ground and that you wouldn't identify at Rawls?
Well, to Tom's point, the views aren't really cut off at Common Ground. I mean, you still have, you know, all the hallmark things of wide playing corridors, bunkers that pierce in, and then interesting greens. But here at the Rawls course, it's, you know, dirt's pushed up on the perimeters, trees were planted, and they tried to cocoon you in to a very attractive environment when all around it was ugly. You know, there's a really telling photograph in Volume 5 of Victoria Golf Club, an aerial picture that shows great architecture, and then beyond the first green, you know, are these, it's just the local neighborhood that surrounds the perimeter. And, you know, the more you can create a pleasing internal environment, the better off you are. And at Common Ground, they didn't make any attempt to do that. Now, the surrounds weren't is presumably ugly. But I don't know if Tom's ever moved more dirt than at the Rawls course. Have you, Tom?
I don't think so. You know, we had to move a lot of earth and a couple other things to get them playable, you know, level enough to be playable. I don't know exactly how much we moved at Stony, to tell you the truth. But I think, you know, the only one that was close was the one in China that never got finished.
Well, one of the
finished, but never opened.
One of the things that I recall, Tom, from an earlier interview I did with you, though, was that what you said was that you moved all that earth at the Rawls course early to make it look like natural erosion, and then you designed the golf courses over that.
No, not really. I mean, you know, you have to. We thought about trying to do something like that, but, you know, donors putting up a lot of money kind of want to see what it's going to look like or have an idea. So I've never had a client that would let me just go kind of make a mess and then try to route something over it. But
well, I wouldn't call it a mess.
No, sometimes that's what it looks like when you're in the middle of construction. It's just like, oh, okay, here's a jumble of stuff, and that looks cool over there. Maybe I can make it green over there instead of where I was thinking. But in this case, we tried to make the landscape look natural, not thinking about golf. So there's a big central lake and there's a bunch of little streams and ravines that kind of feed to it, drain to it naturally. So we gouged all that out and took the dirt to build up the edges. And instead of trying to make it look like a dunes course, because it's not sandy, we tried to make it, we kind of flat topped the mounding on the edges and made it look like it was a bluff that had eroded down from there.
Yes.
We had the golf holes planned in between them, but, the key was not thinking about golf so much when we were shaping landforms and just trying to shape landforms so it looked cool. In fact, at one point, Jim Urbina told us there was, I had a bunch of my own guys there, but we had this other shaper that had worked for a contractor working on the dune stuff because we figured that wasn't, we concentrated on where people were going to hit golf balls. And so he wouldn't overthink what he was doing on the bluffs around the edge of the course. Jim told him that the holes were played backwards from what they did. So in case he was trying to think of what it would look like, he wouldn't be getting it.
Also, Rand, since you mentioned Common Ground, that seems like a place that people could ski and play golf the same day.
Yeah, I don't get the golf and skiing. I mean, dead legs equals bad golf. So
okay, so then don't keep score.
235, I'm not doing it.
I don't know.
You really weigh that much? You don't weigh that much, do you? That can't be right.
Yeah.
Are either one of you skiers, by the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Love it.
And unfortunately, not really. I grew up on the East Coast, and every time somebody would ask me if I wanted to go skiing, they'd come back on crutches, and I just went,
Don't jinx me. Don't jinx me.
Sorry.
Yes, man.
Sorry. I did ski just a little bit. I live in northern Michigan, and we have tiny ski hills around here, but I thought when my son was young, let's get him on skis, and so at least he's not afraid of it like I am. So I did ski just a little bit then, and I could see the appeal. I mean, it is kind of like golf that you're finding the path of least resistance through the terrain the same way that I do when I'm routing a golf course. So I could see, that would really appeal to me in the mountains and the Alps and that sort of stuff.
Building a great ski area is very much like building a great golf course in that you want to show off the best parts of the terrain. And very frequently, a small place like a Magic Mountain in Vermont or a Smuggler's Notch that's got phenomenal, different terrain that's both steep and verdant at the same time and narrow and twists and turns, very much like a great golf course is, the more character it's got, the better it is. People rag on Stratton Mountain, for example. They call it Flatten, or they call it the pumpkin spice latte of ski resorts, simply because it doesn't have a lot of character, supposedly, compared to a Magic. Rand, I interrupted you. You were going to ask me.
No, I did. Well, there, if in Australia, if you drive toward Canberra, in between Sydney and Melbourne, there's some ski hills down there, and you could probably ski in Canberra. But I do agree that I know an uncommon number of skiers and golfers, and it's no surprise to me that if you like one, you would like the other. And in a lot of ways, to the extent that you're frustrated with what happened with modern architecture and it got all junked up and built for homes and so forth, you might find your affinity moving back to skiing, which is a less polluted form of being outdoors. And of course, there are plenty of new ski trails that have been opened up that were opened up just for homes to be placed on them. But in general, a lot of similarities. I mean, they both just get you out into some of the prettiest spots in the entire world.
Yep, and they're all about terrain.
They are all about terrain, exactly. You know, the other interesting thing is the dichotomy between big and small, though. You know, just like in golf, how you have the difference between these huge mega resorts and these huge mega private clubs versus the smaller mom and pop ones that can be just as good. You have the same thing with your mega resorts like your Killingtons and your Cannons and your Sugar Bushes versus the slightly smaller places like, say, a Waterville Valley or a Magic or a Smugglers. And by the way, there's another one that we could think of where you can play golf and ski on the same day. You can ski Waterville Valley and then go play golf at Manchester Country Club, which is a very nice little dollhouse.
That's the difference between skiing. If you have a small ski mountain, you spend all your time in lift lines and going up and down the lift. And in golf, 5,800-yard course really means you're just hitting a lot more shots than you are if you're playing a 6,800-yard course. You're getting more golf in a compressed time. So I'm much more of a fan of short golf courses than short ski hills.
Well, I do have some good news for you. They have something new now. They're called high-speed lifts, okay? You can get a high-speed gondola or a high-speed quad that'll whip you up the mountain in just a couple of minutes. It's funny, that's another one of those battles between the purists and, you know, the casuals, where the purists will say, it's okay to have a slightly longer lift ride up there because you can talk about your last run and plan your next one, while the casual skier might say, no, I want to get as many runs in as I possibly can before it's time to hit the après ski. You know, and each one of those has their benefits. I'll also dot an I and cross a T from earlier. The story I was told, Tom, about Alistair McKenzie and Lake Placid Golf Club or Lake Placid Country Club, I'm forgetting the exact name of it, was that, and I was told this by somebody that worked in the pro shop, was they wrote a letter to McKenzie saying, we've got a problem, a road is going to cut through our golf course and tear apart a couple of our holes, what do we do? And he wrote back a letter with a hand drawing that said, just move the tee box to the other side of the road. That was the extent of his involvement, and yet they still stubbornly said, we are an Alistair McKenzie golf course. It says it on the goddamn scorecard. And he said it with a straight face. That's the funniest part. The other funny part is, on that same trip, my cousin Stanley, you know, who fashioned himself a golfer, but he was really a gorilla with clubs. Okay, was exactly. He was a weightlifter kind of guy. He challenged me to a golf match. He said, I bet you can't break 100. And so I went out and I shot an 84. And everyone is laughing, his two kids, his wife, and the course pro, because he grabbed a copy of the rule book and was sitting there with the rule book trying to ham up 16 penalty shots on me. And then, funnier still, is when he wrote the check out, he was supposed to pay me $300, and the check he wrote me was for $160. He said, hey, what happened to the other $140? Oh, I'm buying dinner tonight. one last question before I let you guys go. We haven't talked yet about Korea. Very quickly, tell us your favorite memories of Korea.
For me, it was, well, I had two. You know, those courses in the mountains outside of Seoul are, you know, it's very different, severe terrain, and, you know, they move 20 times as much dirt as I did at the Rawls course to, you know, make the side of a mountain into a playable golf course. But they, you know, they followed through with enough landscaping effort that if they were clever about how they moved the dirt, something would come out really good. The best of them that I saw is a place called Whistling Rock that Rand saw too. It's just a, you know, a cool golf course, and then it's also got a lot of like modern art type of stuff around it. You know, everywhere in Japan and South Korea that you play golf, it's like every par 3 hole they have a little tea house or something because of its flow and because it's hot and humid, and it's just a place to have a little rest and have a tea house. So there's three on Whistling Rock, and one for each nine. There's 27 holes. And all of them were, you know, just architectural marvels of, you know, they're the coolest little buildings you've ever seen for a halfway house. And, you know, you see a lot of that in Korea. The other place that's impressed everyone that's gone there is a resort called South Cape on the south coast of Korea. And, it's a very luxurious resort, with, I think, seven clifftop holes hanging out over the ocean. I mean, it's a really dramatic piece of work that Kyle Phillips did. And again, a couple of the coolest halfway houses in the world on the same golf course.
Rand, same question.
Just what Tom said. I mean, South Cape might have, you know, one of the finest, both South Cape and Whistling Rock have two of the finest setups for golf courses. South Cape might have one of the world's 10 or 12 greatest set of one-shot holes. And then Whistling Rock's up in the mountains, and so it enjoys grasses where the ball will scoot and run a little bit more than it does down at the southern end of the country at South Cape. So they're the two bookend courses. It's a neat country because they put women's golf on a pedestal. And, you know, I can just relate more to women who drive at 250 yards than I can to guys who are driving it now over 400-yard par 4 greens. So,
yep, very true, very true.
A neat place.
Fellas, tell us where people can order their copies of Volume 5 or any other volume of The Confidential Guide.
The only place to order the books as of right now is still from my office or my website. You just find it at www.renaissancegolf.com and then click on the homepage. There's a link over to the right for the book. So click on the cover of the book, and it's very easy to order.
And, Rand, where can people stay in touch with what you're doing and working on?
Jay, Golf Club Atlas is easy to find. my wife and I are getting ready to go over to Edinburgh in a couple of weeks and just do some train trips to some of the little golf courses like Dunbar, et cetera. So I've always wanted to do a Bernard Darwin type trip where you do it by train, and finally going to get to do it. And I doubt the courses will be packed in February.
And each of you tell me, where are some courses you are looking forward to playing this year?
I've got two or three golf courses to build this year, so I don't know that I'm going to get to play as much golf as I have these last few years.
The correct answer was Forsgate, Tom. you're supposed to say Forsgate. You have the standing open invitation. You also, man. How about you, man? Where might you?
Standing open invitation to everywhere. And I just wish
them. Is that a humble brag?
No, how about that's you? A sad truth.
It's funny, you know, people, they don't realize how much hard work and how tiring it really, really is to do what all three of us do. You know, I don't know about you, but from the moment I open my eyes until the moment I close them at night, you know, it's how I learn on everything because I'm both lawyer and journalist. It's a wonderful life that we have, you know, that we are privileged to be able to give our lives to the game that does so much good for our souls. You know, that's the one thing that I keep coming back to, especially about Forcegate. Forcegate made my golf dreams come true, because as a guy who played public courses all his life and loved them, you know, the chance to walk in the footsteps of history, and even more so, the chance to be an ambassador for the club and turn everybody on to the same excitement that I feel. That's what I love the most about golf. Same thing with skiing, you know, to be able to share with your friends all of the excitement of a truly great golf course. You know, that's a wonderful gift, and that's why our sport is just so superior, I think, to so many others. Man, how about you? Same question.
Well, I'm going to go to Lofoten in Norway as part of Volume 4. The course I'm most looking forward to returning is on the Isle of Jura called Ardfin, and I'm going to head back there. So, it, you know.
Two that I'll be curious to hear your opinions on. One will be Rocco Forte's work at Verdena, and also Jones's work in Sweden. I've been seeing a lot of interest in both of those. Anyway, I can't thank you both enough for coming on the show. Everybody, preeminent golf course architect Tom Doak, and one of the brightest minds in golf design, Rand Morissette. I'm Jay Flemmer. You've been listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. We will be back with our next segment in just a few minutes.
We're at the end of another great Jay's Plays show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as a theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner, including me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJ Q.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Plays show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.